George Hess is my name, and I'm 84 years old. And today is the 6th of May, 2021, and we're in Baltimore, Maryland. And sitting next to me is Charles Obrecht, and he will tell you about himself. He's 86.
Good morning. My name is Charles Obrecht. I am 86, will be 87 in July, born in 1934. I was raised in Baltimore. I've lived here all my life. And the topic that we will deal with today, or talk about today, really involves the relationship between Christianity and Judaism. And of the two of us, I'm the Christian member, and George is the Jewish member.
We've known one another for almost 70 years, and we both had hair at that time. So it's a long time partnership that goes back to when I started at Gilman School here in Baltimore, which at that time had never had a Jewish student. And Charlie was much older, of course. So we didn't know one another well at that time. We got to know one another much better afterwards. And that Jewish relationship to the school was probably the initial impetus for me to get involved in what became the Institute of Christian and Jewish Studies, now Institute for Islamic Christian and Jewish Studies.
So I think the thing that is particularly interesting is that George was the first Jewish student ever to attend this particular school. And I guess my question to you, George, is that came about as a result of your father wanting to
correct
bring about a change.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering two things. One, why did he do that? Why did he think that? And secondly, what was your experience like?
In those days, to keep it as brief as possible, I had my Jewish friends on the weekends and my Gilman friends during the 5 days I went to school. And so the twain didn't meet. And it didn't meet really until after I finished at Gilman. And so that was a factor, a huge factor.
But why did your father send you?
Well,
that's an abrupt break to be the only Jewish student in a school that has never taken a Jewish student before. Why did he do that?
He did it because he felt that I could get a better education there. It was an excellent school, and he knew the headmaster, and because they went to college together, and the headmaster felt that it was time that a Jew was let into the school.
Well, tell me a little bit about your experience there.
Well, it was fine. I mean, you know, there were occasions when people would call me something nasty. But then they added more Jews to the school. Not many, but a few, who did very well. One did not, and he was not asked to return. I mean, he just was so immersed in in being Orthodox Jewish that he couldn't assimilate at all. But by and large, that was, a very good experience, one that I shall never forget. Indeed, you know that I have continued my involvement in school ever since, and actually have been on the board and the president of the board for 50 years. Not the president of the board, but on the board for 50 years.
But weren't you chairman of the board?
Yeah, I was.
Which I think is an extraordinary thing, to go from being the first and only Jewish student and then to become chairman of the board is a nice American story, I think.
Well, we're spending too much time on me, Mr. Charles.
Oh,
all right. So let's get on to.
Let me just say my memory of George at Gilman was only for one reason only, and that was because he was the single Jewish student. He was 3 years behind me, so you don't usually at that age in school have much relationship with younger students and so on. So that's where I knew him. And I just thought it might be interesting, George, if we put this whole experience in a little bit of perspective with regard to what the conditions were in Baltimore at that time. I mean, how did things exist between the Christian and Jewish community from your perspective?
The Jews could not buy a house east of Falls Road. It was difficult to buy a house in Ruxton, a suburb north of Baltimore. And the Jews had their lives, and that was the way it was.
That's the reason the Park School was formed, is that right? Because
Park School was formed many, many years before that, and it has now thrived, and there are other schools that are very active in supporting Jews and all faiths that are doing well. But Gilman, you're going to hear in a minute, has not only thrive, but it too has become so diverse that indeed Jews are a much smaller part of the census than they were 20 years after I started there. But the population of African Americans, Asians, virtually all peoples, it is an incredibly diverse school today.
Yeah, if you go back 40 or 50 years, you might say they were ahead of where we are today. The division that have arisen in this country are really frightening, I think. I, of course, had an entirely different experience. I was a Christian, kind of in name only. My mother attended church, my father didn't. My family simply knew no Jewish persons whatsoever in this city. Which is kind of hard to do because my father was in business, my mother was involved in things, but that never involved anyone from the Jewish community. When I went to college, I'll never forget, I had a friend in the dormitory in which I lived who asked me to go to his home on Brooklyn for one weekend. And we arrived on Friday, which was an occasion for a Shabbat dinner, which I'd never heard of, but didn't know there was any special occasion on Friday nights. And when we arrived and we sat right down to dinner and with the lighting of candles and the prayers and so on, and for literally no reason at all, my family, I never heard a negative thing about Judaism or Jews. They just were never mentioned. They didn't exist. And I was absolutely frightened. is the only way I can describe it. I just felt I was someplace that I shouldn't be. I didn't understand what was going on, and I was scared of death. And that ultimately started me thinking about the relationship between Christianity and Judaism. It was almost my first introduction. And it was a shocking experience for me. I was very ashamed of myself. From then on, I began to grow in that area. I don't know if you're aware of any of that, George, or not.
You not only grew, Charlie, but you developed the perspective that there really should be an organization that was working to bring all the faiths together. And what you came up with in the late 1980s was so revolutionary that creation of the Institute for Islamic Christian Jewish Studies really was groundbreaking for the whole country. And when you hired Chris Layton, I think it was our first head, and he was the Reverend Christopher Layton. He was the chaplain. Yeah. He was a chaplain at the Gilman School. And I guess one would say you liberated him from that job to become the head of the first head of the ICJS. And in his wonderful way, he really went after all three traditions to get us going. And he was good at it.
Yeah, let me put that whole movement in what George was talking about with the Institute for Christian Studies and some historical perspective. Christianity and Judaism, and this will be a short history to us, Christianity and Judaism really didn't part their ways. For almost 200 years after the death of Jesus. But during that time, kind of three pillars developed between these two faiths. One was that Judaism had been totally superseded by Christianity, and that Judaism was a dead religion. The second thing was that the Jews killed Jesus. And as Jesus became identified totally as God, the Jews killed God. You can't have a greater crime than that if you're a Christian. And then as a result of St. Augustine in the 3rd century, he came up with the idea that Jews must be protected, which is kind of unusual in view of what Christianity has done to the Jewish people. But the reason was this. The Jews were to continue to exist, but to exist in misery and with no homeland and to roam the earth forever. And the reason that was important to Augustine was that it provided a living symbol of what happens to people who don't recognize the divinity of Jesus. So that was the basis that develops in the next 2,000 years, 1,800 years, with some ups and downs. Sometimes things, relations were better, sometimes they were worse. But ultimately, it led to, played a major significant role in the Holocaust. Very few people know that in Germany in 1934 they started the implementation of the Nuremberg Laws, which disenfranchised the Jewish people from every conceivable human right. And what people don't know is that every one of those laws came sometimes even word for word from prior official church doctrine. So that's what our heritage was, and that's why in cities like Baltimore, other cities in this country, there was this division which was nurtured by religious teachings. Unlike the problems that we experience with racism today, which is a terribly serious problem in our country. But that involved other issues. But with Christianity and Judaism and Islam now, it was based on the difference in religion. I don't know what your feeling is on that.
I think you stated it well. What you have said was the groundwork that brought together some 25 or 30 mainly business people, but also people of faith,
clergy,
that created an organization that really was designed to say, look, everybody, or a lot of people, not everybody, but everybody thinks that there is something bigger than all of us, that there is a God of some sort. Call it a God. And if one reckons with the fact that that is part of our tradition in this country, then we really ought to try to make things work between the faiths, so that we all agree that we can worship in our own way, and we can also believe that we are not the supreme beings of the universe, so to speak, in our own right. And our curriculum since then at the ICJS has really been built on that. Is that a fair statement?
I think it is. I think one of the things that is interesting is that change did begin to come about. It came about for possibly three reasons, maybe there are more. But one was the Holocaust. Many Christian theologians, Germany had been the absolute center of Christian intellectual thought. And how could an event such as the Holocaust occur in the very center of Christianity? That began to challenge a lot of Christian theologians. The second thing was the founding of the State of Israel. The Jews were never to have a homeland again. They would roam the earth forever, but here they have a homeland. That's in contrast to Christian theology. How did that happen? And then the third thing was just an extraordinarily fortunate and brave thing by the Roman Catholic Church. And I say that as a Presbyterian, so I'm not a Homer with regard to the Catholic Church. But Pope John the 23rd, when he became Pope, they elected him because they wanted someone who wasn't going to live long and wasn't going to upset the apple cart because they'd been through terrible turmoil in World War II. But 2 months after he was elected to be the Pope, he called for a Vatican Council. Absolutely shocked the Catholic world because you didn't do that. And then he went even further than that. He said, we're going to reform the church. We're going to change things. And the American Jewish Committee saw this as an opportunity, maybe the only opportunity they'd ever had, to erase the anti-Semitism that was so deeply embedded in not just the Catholic Church, but all of Christianity. And they sent a man by the name of Jules Isaac to meet with the Pope, which the Pope immediately agreed to do. And he described what had been his experience and what had been the experience of the Jewish people. He had written a book called The Teaching of Contempt, Israel and Judaism. That led to a statement by the Catholic Church known as Nostra Aetate in our times. And that statement, I can best describe it in the words of a Episcopal theologian by the name of Paul Dornbjerg. And he said that it is of such importance theologically that when the dust finally settles, it will make the events of the Reformation seem like a minor blimp in history. In other words, this view of Christianity, of owning the truth, was so embedded and so part of Christianity that it would upset virtually everything that it had been built upon, or at least require rethinking of. So it was a major a change, and we give credit to the to the Catholic Church, I think, at least for me, George. And,
yeah, I think.
In the family,
yeah. And then I think the other event that we have to want to bring into this is the whole De Bruy Met.
Yeah, what the ICJS. What made it unique was this. Number one, it was unique. There was no independent, private, scholarly led, but controlled by lay people that existed to try to assist the various denominations to rethink what they had taught and preached about Jews and Judaism. It had been disastrous for the Jewish people. They'd lost millions of people because of it. And in an entirely different way, it had been disastrous for the Christian church that preached a theology of love and acceptance. And what they did to the Jewish people stood in such sharp contrast. I don't know if you've ever looked at it that way or not, George.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, you know, the Jews needed to make a statement. And that's where this came into being.
Yeah.
And the ICJS became the catalyst that made it happen.
Yeah, when we started, we started dealing solely with Christianity. Christians won't like this, but they were the villains, so to speak. What Chris Layton, our director, did, was to create a curriculum himself for 10 Christian denominations, mainly mainline denominations, much more difficult to deal with the fundamentalists or evangelicals. Each of them studied independently and to look at what their church had taught and preached and what changes they might recommend. And I'll just cite one of them, which I thought is important. The Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, after a 3-year study, produced a document that condemned what Luther had taught about the Jewish people, which was that you lock them into their churches and burn it to the ground and cover it over with dirt. He said that because the Jews had not converted, which he thought they would do. Forgot where it was, George.
Well, I mean, I think you were talking about you're entitled to a little.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, that's what happens when you're 87 years old.
You're not. You're not, Charlie. Not till July.
Okay,
all right. So, but the point here is that the ICJS was making a contribution to trying to get the face to understand one another.
I do remember where I was there.
All right.
So what was the importance of this statement that this ICJS study group came out with regard to the Lutheran Church. They wrote a statement which apologized for what their teaching had been, condemned Luther. And 2 years later, I think it was 1991, it was adopted by the entire Lutheran Church of America, which provided a groundwork in which all Lutheran scholarship from that time on had to take into account. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum opened the year before that, or the year after that. And when the statement came out, they had a movie which opens that experience at the museum that they encourage everyone to see. And they thought that the statement was of such importance and of such significance that they redid the ending of the movie to include what the Lutheran Church had done. Now that movie has been seen by somewhere between 25 and 35 million people in that time. I don't know the exact number, but that's the number that the museum estimates have seen that movie. So it's of enormous significance, and the ICJS played the central role in that. And that's just one example of many things that the Institute did. What are some of the things that strike you, George, that they did?
I would, before I get to that, I think there's a whole aspect of the ICJS that people should know. The ICJS was operating initially on the third floor of the offices of a church in downtown Baltimore. And Charlie, in his inimitable way, because he is in the construction business to a great measure, figured out that we ought to have a building of our own. And so he arranged for a purchase of a building in a wonderful location on the north side of Baltimore.
Goucher College.
Across the street from Goucher College. And this, he, in fact, orchestrated the construction of what is the headquarters of the ICJS, which we own. I mean, the ICJS owns it. And it's a wonderful facility to operate from, literally for around the country. And we have that facility now with our endowment, which is substantial. I mean, very substantial. Gives us the basis to pay our staff. And I think there are 11 or 12 people now on staff.
12.
Yeah. And it enables us to do the kind of teaching both locally, and we try it in other cities in person, to try to get people to understand one another better. And I suspect that we'll be doing more of it online in the future for people. But I think it's very important for people to know that along with the substantive stuff that Charlie has been talking about, and I've mentioned to a degree, this place is not going away. We've clearly set our sights on trying to help people, even in these times when religion is less important than it ever was, to recognize that there is something to be said for believing in a God, however you choose to do it. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, except that I take exception to the thing, the issue about religion. It is true that among our millennial generation, that increasing percentages of them, alarming increasing percentages of them, claim that they have no affiliation with any particular faith. But at the same time, only between 1 and 2% claim that they're agnostic or atheist.
Okay.
And as I analyze that, and whether that's crazy or not, I don't know, I think the primary reason that they're opting out of organized, established religion is that they look at the record. And the record is for Islam, or for Christians looking at Islam, 9/11, for Jews looking at the Holocaust and what the church did in supporting that work. They look at the record of religion and they see that it has been the source of enormous conflict at its worst. And they tend to forget the enormous power it has to enrich the lives of people and to lead to the kind of wisdom that you get from a Martin Luther King or Gandhi. So that my feeling is that it's more important than ever, particularly in the world we live today, because we live in a world where we're now integrated in a way we never were before, where people can get hold of weapons of mass destruction and destroy the world and kill millions of people. And the primary force standing against that is an organized religion that tries to seek out a respect and a cooperation and a willingness to work with those who differ religiously.
Well, I think you might want to talk a little about the organizational structure that really, I think, we helped to create at the ICJS that implements that. Well, we've always, with Chris Layton, we had a Christian scholar who is the head. We now have a Roman Catholic head, and she is the Roman Catholic scholar as well as being the head. And we have an Islamic scholar who is super bright woman who's got it. We have a Jewish scholar, and he's another one who gets it, and the same with our Protestant scholar. And then on top of that, we are operating with a facility that has a library, not only a book library, but an online library. And obviously we have to have a finance person, a fundraising person, and all that kind of stuff. So we're in this to try to, at least I think the organization, the ICJS, that it exists can make a real difference in this world. And it's not going to be done immediately because you have some people around now who are lying more and I won't mention names because I don't think that's necessary, but you have others who are trying to finagle their way into office. But somehow or other, my view is that that this kind of organization can make the world a better place, and I'm really pleased that we've lived through it. you primarily have built it, and we're, you know, we're now, I guess, what, 33 years old, something like that?
Yeah, and it's interesting the point you make in making it a better world. When we first started, we brought down to Baltimore a man by the name of Rabbi Irving Greenberg, who headed the Center for Jewish Study and Culture in New York.
Yeah.
That didn't exactly, but anyway, certainly one of the great, he became the head of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, one of the great Jewish scholars.
Called Yitz.
That's right. And Yitz. One of the things we wanted to know was whether we could raise money to do the kind of work we wanted to do and what kind of support we'd get. And his answer to that was this. He said, you know, there are a lot of in-your-face pressing problems in the world. There's poverty and there's prejudice of our African-American community. There's economic injustice. There's all sorts of problems that are just really pressing. Housing for people and so on. He said, but the thing about what you're doing, it deals with every one of those problems. Religion across the board has some impact in virtually everything we do. And therefore, what you're doing, which he later described as the most comprehensive combination of scholarly and lay work that goes on anywhere in the world today. That's what his viewpoint 10 years later was of the ICJS.
I think we've covered it pretty well for you.
Let me end with one thing that I think is the challenge to all of our religious communities, not just three we deal with, but all of the world's five great religions. There was a wonderful rabbi who was born in America but immigrated to Israel. His name was David Hartman. Time magazine had him, had a major story on him many years ago, describing him as the very soul of Israel. And he always told this story. He said, before the birth of Jesus, within Judaism, there were two schools of thought. One was headed by Hillel, and the other by Shammai. And there was tremendous conflict between them. They agreed on some things, but they disagreed on many, many others. And the Jewish leaders and scholars at that time, after fighting and fighting, came to this conclusion. Who's right? And so they decided, well, the best way to find that out is to ask God. And so they report in the Talmud that they did ask God, and the answer came back to them as follows. The Torah is according to Hillel. And the reason it's in accordance with Hillel is when he teaches, he always presents the position of Shammai first, and he argues for it with integrity. Then and only then does he present his position. So the Torah is according to Hillel, because these and these are the living word of God. No one has a monopoly on truth.
Let me add one more thought, and I think we're done. And that is that the current head of the ICJS board is a member of Islam. And he's doing an absolutely super job of bringing Islam, which is the latest part of our organizational structure in the last 5 years, into the middle of it. And not pushing it in, but doing it as Hillel and Shammai were doing it with the Torah.
But it remains a big challenge.
Oh, yeah.
And I hope we're up to it.
Yeah, we'll work at it.
Thank you.